My name is Sonali Dohale, and myself, along with my co-development editor, Stacey Karras, have planned a speaker series for this semester entitled Mapping America's Energy Future, The Obstacles to Energy Policy. Our first panel today will be on the impact of environmental and natural disasters on energy policy in the United States. And we have two fantastic panelists with us today, Mr. Daniel Farber, the Shoshito Professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and Mr. Stephen Burns, current General Counsel of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Once again, thank you for coming. And what will happen today is that each of our speakers will give a presentation, and then at the end of both of their presentations, we'll open it up for a question and answer period. And so the first person to speak will be Mr. Stephen Burns. A U.S. national, Mr. Burns received his law degree with honors in 1978 from George Washington University. He received his B.A. degree, magna cum laude, in 1975 from Colgate University in Hamilton, New York. And he is a member of the American Bar Association and the International Nuclear Law Association. Mr. Burns was then appointed General Counsel of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission in May 2009 after serving as NRC's Deputy General Counsel since 1998. As General Counsel, he was responsible for legal advice and representation for the NRC. Mr. Burns joined the NRC as an attorney in 1978 and has worked on a number of significant issues involving nuclear safety and regulation. He received the NRC Distinguished Service Award in 2001 and the Presidential Meritorious Executive Rank Award in 1998 and in 2008. Mr. Burns has also served as a member of the U.S. delegation to the NEA Nuclear Law Committee. He has also been a lecturer for the NEA Nuclear Law Education Programs in Paris and Montpellier, France. And this April, he will be leaving the NRC to serve as head of legal affairs for the OECD Nuclear Energy Agency in Paris, France. Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Mr. Stephen Burns.
Thanks, Sonali. I sort of went kind of funny when she mentioned I was a U.S. national, and I realized what she was doing is using the OECD press release where they always tell people who newly appointed officials are from. I didn't have my passport with me, but anyway. I'm pleased to be here. I met Sonali last summer while she was up in Washington on an internship and sort of range, and I'm happy to be down here. And I want to talk to you today a little bit about some perspectives on Fukushima and nuclear regulation, and perhaps some thoughts on, you know, where does that leave us in terms of nuclear power in the United States, and perhaps a little bit in the international community. First thing, and again, I'm a lawyer, not an engineer, but I have some familiarity having followed for the last year the Fukushima accident. This is basically what, in a nutshell, what happened. Now, there was an earthquake, as you know, a magnitude 9 earthquake, which actually the engineers aren't so interested in that number. What they're really interested in is ground motion. And the ground motion was in effect, I think, something like 0.6 Gs. So 0.6 of the Gs in terms of the force of gravity. That's the thing that's actually of most interest to most engineers. So the earthquake happens. What happens then? Three operating plants at the Fukushima site, which has six plants, shut down automatically as designed. There was a loss of off-site power, meaning their connection to the grid went down. So you don't have no power coming into the site. Then a tsunami wave floods the site and knocks out emergency diesel generators at the site. In the picture you see here, this is actually Unit 5, which is actually one of those that basically survived the plant. This is the tsunami wave that has now come in. It was a 45-foot tsunami that hits the site. And the interesting thing here is this part of the plant, units 5 and 6, was actually on higher ground than units 1 through 4, which are clustered together in a lower portion of the site. Okay, so what happens is you can't get these what do these diesel generators do? They provide emergency power to the systems that you need to continue certain plant safety functions. So what does that mean? The operators have limited capability to maintain core cooling and other essential systems. They're basically relying on batteries or sometimes turbine-driven pumps or things like this. And so eventually, all three units that had been operating that shut down sustained some form of core damage, one within hours, another one within about a day, and another within about two and a half days. Also, the Unit 4, which was shut down, there's an uncertain status with respect to its spent fuel pool. And there was a lot of debate whether that pool was dry, which is what folks in the U.S. and my agency thought, or whether it still had water in it to keep spent fuel cool. As it turns out, we think there was actually, in retrospect, that there was water in the pool. Now, what if you watched this on TV, you saw a lot of these, you saw things blowing up, right? Essentially, that's not the reactor itself. What that is a buildup of gas, hydrogen gas, in basically, think of the large shed or the large building over where the reactor sits. The hydrogen gas, which is very explosive, builds up, it explodes. What that does, the significance of that, is that makes the ability to get to the plant and certain types of systems that would help either makes it very difficult or severely damaged. Obviously, as we know, the radiation levels in the area prompted an evacuation. The Japanese government to evacuate some of the area. Some controversy, the U.S. recommended its citizens and military evacuate to a larger area. So in sum, in a very nutshell, that is what the accident was. Today, they have been able to, as of December, and it took until December last year, to basically stabilize the cores in the three damaged reactors. You still have basically an exclusion zone around the plant. People have been allowed to go in and get personal effects and do some other things, but there's still an exclusion zone. Now, in terms of loss of life, the loss of life from what happened there was from the earthquake and the tsunami, not from radiation releases from the plant. And partly that is because the Japanese government did have people move out. That's a significant difference between this accident and the Chernobyl accident in 1986, where there's sustained exposure early on in the accident created more health effects. Of course, another difference between this accident and the Chernobyl accident was it took the Swedish government, or basically Swedish nuclear operators, to discover that something was going on. Because in Sweden, at one of the Swedish nuclear plants, they were getting elevated readings, radiation readings in 1986. Nobody understood what happened. And of course, what was happening is in the Ukraine, the Russian government was covering up the accident at Chernobyl for several days. Here we watch it on CNN or on even, I was watching it on the Japanese television feed. So in terms of what we're actually aware of going on was something quite different. In terms of what was the response in the United States, the initial response was, of course, support to Japan. We sent a team of experts along with the USAID who were helping with the recovery of people in collapsed buildings and all. We sent a team of nuclear experts to support the Japanese government and to support our ambassador in Japan. We initiated at the NRC inspections of U.S. plants for certain types of, whether they were prepared for certain types of measures. After 9/11, one of the upgrades that the NRC required actually had a beneficial effect in this area, and that was staging equipment so that a plant, if it were struck by a large explosion or fire, would be able to mitigate or try to recover from damage that might be experienced. So we went out to inspect how the plants had done that, and we found some things that needed to be improved. The agency, the chairman, initiated with the commission's support within a couple weeks of the accident a review, which we'll talk about in a couple minutes, of U.S. plant safety and regulatory requirements. We had an extraordinary increase, as you can imagine, about filings, petitions to shut down plants, petitions to impose safety requirements and the like. We had the Third Circuit was reviewing one of our cases, a relicensing of a plant in New Jersey, and sua sponte, the Third Circuit, asked the parties whether the accident, this is about a week after the accident, whether the accident had any effect on the court's consideration of the case. Now, think about that again. Courts are really about procedure and whether the agency, in accordance with the APA, has articulated a rational decision. They're not technical courts, yet the court here was prompted to do so. Eventually, the NRC decision in the case was sustained. We had intense political interest. We probably went to about half a dozen hearings within the month after the accident. And I've said this in other fora, and I say so not all, completely facetiously, but going in front of a U.S. Senate committee, and it was almost like some of the senators were saying, we have nuclear power plants in this country. It was like it had, was totally, totally beyond some of them at that point. We had extraordinarily heavy FOIA requests. You can imagine. And in fact, last week we released the transcripts from our operations center, somewhat redacted. And you can go to the website and find the redacted portions, and there's some clips about it. And they do give, I think, a revealing sense about, on this side of the ocean, how relatively, if not relatively in the dark, but how challenging it was to understand what was going on in Japan. So that's in terms of the initial U.S. response. In the international community, we have a number of mixed reactions. I think very famously people know that what was really a fragile consensus in Germany about going forward with new nuclear and extending life of existing nuclear plants essentially was shattered. And Chancellor Merkel, basically the government reversed its position and has gone to a basically closure of plants in Germany by year 2022, did not allow some plants to restart. Referendum in Italy, which was may have actually turned down the government's initiative to resume a nuclear program, was turned down. Nonetheless, in a number of countries, including what we call new entrants, the United Arab Emirates, which basically their regulatory agency is retired NRC people, I might add, but the UAE, Poland, Vietnam, the United Kingdom have proceeded on continuing their plans. The European Union focused on stress tests, and the stress test comes from the financial sector. That word comes from the financial sector. It actually bothered me when I first heard this because I thought they were going to try to pump up the containments to see what would happen to them. And so they said, no, it's a paper exercise, Steve. And what they're doing is basically you're looking at the design and seeing, comparing the design to what the types of natural hazards are and what would happen. The OECD NEA, where I'm going to be working, the IAEA, which has is the depository for the Convention on Nuclear Safety, or ministerial meetings held. Within a couple weeks of the accident, a routine meeting, which is like a triennial meeting of the Convention on Nuclear Safety, was meeting in Vienna. There was some consideration whether to cancel it, but they decided to go forward with it. This is basically a peer review conference on nuclear safety. But as a consequence, they came out and they were going to have what they call an extraordinary meeting. That's the term of art that they use in 2012. And in September 2011 at its general conference, the IAEA endorsed, the 150 member states endorsed an action plan on nuclear safety, which does things like look at the independence of regulatory bodies, an issue, I think, coming out of Fukushima. The international liability regime, the stress tests and the defense in depth in terms of the safety of plants, a number of issues and legal issues. I wanted to mention this little drawing on the side. I was in Paris in June for a meeting at NEA. This was something I pulled off a lamppost, a protest, the Place de la République the weekend before. And this, gives you an idea. This accident, and rightly so, garnered worldwide attention. Okay, what does it mean for the United States? This is just a picture that shows you this is where existing nuclear power plants are in the United States. There are 104 operating plants. It's about 20% of U.S. electricity. We're going to talk about new plants right now or in a few minutes. But essentially, the new plants are where those couple little triangles at the top in Georgia are. That's where the Vogtle plant is. And then there's another two plants, which were likely to be approved soon in South Carolina. And these are plants that actually, I think, will be built. There are a number of others on the docket. We'll talk about those in a few minutes, but I just want to give you a picture. This is where, basically, nuclear plants are in the country. And you have, in this country, what I would say, in terms of public acceptance, we are more regional than we are sort of unified. You can get polls that say, you know, 60% of the people in the country still support nuclear power, but that may vary from region to region. The most friendly region for new nukes, for example, would say is in the southeast, and that sort of crescent down there. New England, there's some very interesting things going on, and in fact, a case to watch, a preemption case coming out of the state of Vermont, which the state lost and has now decided to appeal, trying to close down the Vermont Yankee plant, which is an older facility that's up there. But anyway, that gives you a picture of where the plants are in the country. Okay, what does it mean for U.S. regulation? Our group of people from within the NRC, taken out of their normal responsibilities, came up with a task force report, which was, I think, a lot of people were surprised at how comprehensive and it was in the short period of time that they had to do it. And while they found no imminent risk or in no imminent risk of harm that would require shutting down plants, because again, the things that happened to Fukushima, these are not unthought of things. It's a question of really in terms of where you, how have you designed, how have you thought about mitigation of accidents, what's the robustness of the plants, and for the most part, the U.S. plants would stand up pretty well, but the task force. And the task force didn't recommend stopping new licensing, but it did say that the commission needs to focus on a number of significant things that go to what is called or widely known as the defense in depth system. Defense in depth depends on, that says you don't rely on one single thing to prevent an accident, but basically what you're doing is trying in the regulatory scheme and in the design scheme and the operation is to mesh and overlay a number of factors. Design is certainly one of those things, and one of the things that the task force recommended is a need to harden plant designs and plant systems and some of the mitigating systems, to look at improving mitigating measures that are used, not only the machinery and not only the equipment, but how one thinks about handling an accident, because human beings have an important role to play here. And finally, the last part of defense in depth, it is in effect emergency planning and emergency response. That's something we learned out of Three Mile Island and why you have comprehensive plans around plants or nuclear power plants as a result of requirements that came out of Three Mile Island. In terms of near-term actions, this is where I see the NRC going and is about to endorse a number of steps that utilities who operate plants are going to have to address in the next year to a couple years. One is they're going to have to re-examine their design basis for external hazards. If that isn't important, the fact that that is important came home last year. In this state, very close by, where we have the largest earthquake in 100 years, happened near the North Anna plant, the 5.6 magnitude quake. And also, if some of you may have seen a plant on the Missouri River, but basically was basically below sea level at the time because of flooding on the Missouri. But hardening plants to deal with things like seismic and flooding events is an important thing. Dealing with the station blackout capability. That was the thing that they couldn't get power back into the systems to maintain core cooling. Being able to recover from that, having longer periods of time to be able to operate or to handle a situation before you get the diesels back in is important. Again, developing other strategies to deal with accidents. This is the other thing about Fukushima. This is the first multi-plant accident. In history. Chernobyl was one plant, TMI was a single unit. Again, knowing what's going on in spent fuel pools, that's another area you're going to see, I think, an order from the NRC to plants in the next few weeks. And then for these older BWRs is a boiling water reactor. It's just a design. This is a General Electric design, which was what the plants in Fukushima were, which are a number of plants in this country are also and of that vintage. This hardened vent, this is to release the hydrogen sort of slowly and methodically, rather than pricking a balloon and having it pop, in effect sort of letting it, you know, letting the gas out. That's the analogy, letting the gas out slowly. Finally, what does this mean in terms of new plant licensing? Recently, the NRC approved a standardized design for the Westinghouse advanced plant. Most of these plants will deal with, in terms of some of the issues you saw at Fukushima, by their design, are much more robust in that regard. You still need to design for seismic and other natural hazards. That design is going to be used at the Vogtle plant in Georgia. That's a picture of the Vogtle site down there, and are likely to be approved for summer. We have a number of applications pending, but I would say that, you know, whether those are going to be built, they may be banked, but they may or may not be built, is an open question. And part of that is not so much Fukushima. I think Fukushima, if it did anything, I would say sort of an optimism about a nuclear renaissance, it certainly put a damper on that. It did not, I think, end consideration by utilities of future nuclear sites and future nuclear plants. And for example, the administration has still been strongly supportive. But I think, you know, it's certainly a damper. I would say the other things that are perhaps of more, are probably more of a question or raise the question about where new nuclear goes are things like it's unclear whether issues about carbon pricing, where that's going. The question about natural gas, and this goes to fracking and the Marcellus Shale and the Utica Shale reserves, the price of natural gas, again, being low and seen as an energy source, that has an impact on nuclear, because nuclear is, as a in terms of building the infrastructure, building the plant is quite expensive, even though plants are relatively cheap to operate. Long term, what I think you may see is an interest in smaller modular designs. Partly this is, even the military is interested in this for base, having reliable energy at a base, but there's smaller designs. You don't have, when I say smaller, you're talking about 100 megawatt plant versus 1,000 to 1,500 megawatt plant. And there's, again, some interest in that, and you may see that. And some, what I say is, you're certainly from the standpoint of an effect on, in terms of a program, what I've tried to describe is this is how, you know, seeing an accident, even though it happens worldwide or in across the ocean, there's a worldwide response. And partly because I think the nuclear and nuclear energy, it is a much more integrated system than it was when I started work at the NRC 30 years ago. And I think in many ways that's good. I think the international community has a good focus in terms of nuclear safety and has the capability. Ultimately, the question is going to be some of the commitment. So with that, I look forward to Dr. Farber's remarks.
Thank you. We're going to switch gears a little bit with Professor Farber from the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. Farber is the Shou Sato Professor there, and he is also the chair of the Energy and Resources Group. He's also the co-director of the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. Professor Farber serves on the editorial board of Foundation Press. He's also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a life member of the American Law Institute. He is the editor of Issues in Legal Scholarship, and Professor Farber is a graduate of the University of Illinois, where he earned his BA, his MA, and his JD. There he graduated summa cum laude from the College of Law, where he was class valedictorian, and served as editor-in-chief of the University of Illinois Law Review. After graduation from law school, he clerked for Judge Philip W. Tone of the United States Courts of Appeal for the Seventh Circuit. He then clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens of the Supreme Court. Professor Farber practiced law with Sidley Austin, where he primarily worked on energy issues, before joining the University of Illinois College of Law faculty in 1978. He was a member of the University of Minnesota Law School faculty from 1981 until 2002, where he was the McKnight Presidential Professor of Public Law. He also has been a visiting professor at Stanford Law, Harvard Law, and the University of Chicago Law School. He has written extensively about both environmental and constitutional law, including leading casebooks on both topics. With no further ado, Professor Farber.
Yeah, don't worry, it's not all, you know, at an angle. There are really three big systems that our civilization is really caught up in. One is the climate system, one is the energy system, and one is the water system, and they're all tightly interrelated, much more, I think, than many people realize. Now, obviously, there are many ways that disasters can impact the energy system, including technological failures like the BP oil spill and to some extent Fukushima, and also natural disasters of various kinds. Flooding is actually a major issue, even apart from tsunamis. But these are all kind of accidental connections to some extent. That is, it happens that power plants are often located in places that could flood, but there's nothing really intrinsic to the technology that leads to that, or at least it's not a very strong link. So I thought I would focus on something that's really kind of endemic to much of the energy sector, and that's the connection with heat waves and drought. The link, which I think comes as a surprise to many people, certainly surprised me when I first learned about it, is the huge use of water by the energy sector. And as a result of that, there is a vulnerability to extreme events that will become more important because of climate change. So we're going to be seeing more and more of this. So I'm going to talk first a little bit about the climate system, about how climate change will affect extreme heat and drought events. Then I'll talk about the impacts on thermal electricity generators, which are basically fossil fuels and nuclear. They're things where you use heat essentially to generate energy that you later turn into electricity. I'll talk a little bit about, if I have time, about impacts on fuel production, but less about that, partly because of lack of time and also because it's complicated and I haven't really delved into it as deeply. And then I'll have a couple of brief concluding thoughts. So, climate change, heat waves, and drought. According to the IPCC, in the last report, it is very likely that we will be seeing more heat extremes, more heat waves, and more heavy precipitation. And one of the ironies is we'll also often get droughts and then floods in the same places. So may have equal amounts of precipitation, but falling very irregularly in large rainfall with punctuating long periods with less rain. I think one of the important things to know about climate change, I apologize for those who are phobic toward graphs and things like that, but this is just your regular bell curve. And the important point is what happens on the extremes when you shift the bell curve. This one is actually shifted in the wrong direction for my purposes, but I didn't have enough technical skill to make a different slide. But what you can see is, let's say that shows how often you're going to get an event that runs over that threshold of that blue line. You know, so something that might now be, let's say, a 1 in 20 year event. And what you can see is with just a fairly small move in the center of the distribution, just on average a little bit more rain every year, But look at how much bigger that triangle becomes, right? So the frequency of extreme events, of heavy rainfall in this picture, goes up quite disproportionately to the movement in the mean it looks like a factor of maybe even 30 if you look at the relative size of those triangles. Here's another set of graphs illustrating that, but this time with extreme temperatures. Now, one thing that can happen is that the variance can increase, right? So we could have more variation in events, and that greatly increases the number of extreme events, even if the average has not changed at all. And that's something we may well see with climate change. But also with even a small move in the mean, we also again get a much larger increase in the extreme events. So one of the things that I think is most important to understand about climate change in general, probably more important than any of the details that I'm going to be talking about, is that even if you assume that that climate change only changes the average temperature a little bit and average rainfall a little bit and doesn't do anything else in the way of changing frequencies and variation, it'll still show up in a big increase, big changes in extreme events. And that's just because of the nature of statistics. And accordingly, the IPCC forecasts that it's virtually certain that increases in warm weather extremes will occur in the 21st century and decreases in cold extremes, and very likely that the length, frequency, or intensity of heat waves will increase over most land areas. Now, that's not going to be true everywhere, but in many places it's going to be true. There's actually, I don't have it in this presentation, but there's a really nice graphic that I've seen that shows the number of days in the year, number of places where a high record, high temperature record or a low temperature record is hit during that year. And what you see is if you go back to the 1950s, they're about balanced, about equal numbers of high temperature records and low temperature records, which is what you'd expect just on the basis of random variation. But as you go forward to the present, what you see is a big shift, so that there are now a lot more high temperature records set on any given year than there are low temperature records. And that's reflecting, again, this movement in the mean that changes the extremes. On average, who knows how much the temperature is going to change? We can't be positive, but probably 1 to 3 degrees centigrade, which is, you can roughly double for Fahrenheit, by mid-century, and 2 to 5 by late century, and let's hope it's not 5. These are actually higher than the average global temperature change, because changes on land will be bigger than changes over the ocean. Right, so even if the average temperature of the Earth only goes up 1 degree during a certain period of time, temperatures on land will go up by more than that, especially in internal areas, and temperatures in the Arctic will go up even more significantly. So here's an example. Number of heat wave days in Los Angeles is expected to at least double by mid-century. It should be, I don't know. That should, something got wrong on that slide. It should be by mid-century and quadrupling by the end of this century. Droughts we're less sure about. In general, it's harder to predict precipitation than temperatures, but we expect that droughts will intensify in some places, and in particular in central North America, and a variety of other parts of the world. According to regional studies, we will see a transition to a more arid climate in the Southwest, probably including prolonged droughts, multi-year droughts. Now, those are not all that unusual in the historical record anyway. We have had actually a relatively wet period for the Southwest compared to many times in the last 1,000 years. But climate change will accentuate the return. Now, of course, we may not call all these things droughts and heat waves, because over time we may establish a new normal where our definition of a heat wave requires, you know, temperatures of 105 degrees instead of 100 degrees. or something like that. But relative to where we are now, we'll see a lot more of what we would now call heat waves. Now, this could affect the energy system in many ways. You know, it's not a very dramatic effect, but as you know, severe rainstorms, windstorms, snowstorms, et cetera, take down power lines, that will become a more substantial problem as time goes on. Your local power company will care about that. The middle one is the one I'm going to talk about more. And then there's the fact that there's a lot of stuff built by the coasts, and which will be affected by sea level change. And it's partly built by the coasts because that's where the water is, and so that's a convenient place. I don't know if you noticed, but in the slide of the Fukushima slide, there was just a little sliver of the ocean that was showing on the slide because it's built really, really close to the ocean, and that's why, so that they'd have that water available. Okay, so now let's look at the other piece of the puzzle: water and electricity generation. It turns out that generating electricity uses a lot of water. Some of the water is used for turbines in hydropower, which is kind of obvious. That's why it's called hydro. Or to produce steam to run turbines in thermal plants, including some of the nuclear plants, and a lot of coal-fired plants. But that's sort of a design issue. But what's almost intrinsic in the use of thermal plants is you got to cool things. And to do that takes a lot of water. So you're not necessarily using the water up. You can return it, but there's a lot of throughput in the system. It depends a little bit on whether you have a once-through system, which uses a lot more water, or a recirculating closed system, which has less water throughput, but you actually lose more water in the process. So hydropower is obviously at risk from droughts. You need water to run those turbines. And we can expect to see some of those impacts, unfortunately, just at the time when we'd like to make more use of hydropower. And so, for example, in the European 2003 heat wave, there was reduced hydropower in France by about 20%. And we're seeing issues in the Southwest with some of the big dams and declining reservoirs. So that's something that we need to be worrying about. For the thermal plants, which are about 90% of U.S. electricity, that accounts for a really surprising amount of water use. It's 40% of total water withdrawals, 39% of freshwater withdrawals, but 3% of consumption. So a lot of that stuff is just flowing through. There's a thermal pollution issue when it goes out. There's fish impingement issues when it comes in. But we're not actually losing the water. But we still need to have that water to cool the plants. Carbon capture, which we would like to do more of for many of these plants, at least according to many observers, will increase water needs. And I'm taking their word for it. I don't actually know technically what it is about the process that makes that true. So here's some examples of drought impacts we've already seen in the U.S. In 2001, which is a big drought, we saw reduced hydropower resources for the Pacific Northwest and Northern California. And in Idaho, we have this other problem too, as if the water flow is reduced and the power plant's still taking the same amount, that's going to have a much bigger impact on the stream if there's not that much water, other water in the stream. So you're going to see more conflicts between environmental goals for the streams and the needs of the power system. And here's a map that shows the sites of many of those possible issues. Please don't ask me what the issues are in any of those specific places. I mostly included the slide just to show that this is not just a regional thing. This is pretty much everywhere, one way or another. There are potential issues. Even in the Southeast, which we think of as being a very water-rich area, but we know from recent events that's not always going to be true. And what matters for these purposes is not the average year, right? Things can be just fine in the average year, 9 years out of 10, or 19 years out of 20, but it's that exceptional year when you're going to have the big problem. Nuclear reactors, this was something else that surprised me, but they actually had to close down at least one reactor during a 2006 heat wave. Other reactors cut their output or were given special permits to dump more hot water into rivers and just have a greater environmental impact in order to avoid power failures. And France also had to import power. And one of the problems with these heat waves, too, there are two problems. One is they're often connected with droughts. But the other thing is the water is warmer, so it's not as good for cooling. And so that can cause problem by itself. And on top of that, this is the time when you most want the power, right? People are really suffering. They want the air conditioning. They want to keep their fans running. You don't want to have blackouts or brownouts. Okay, now let me just talk briefly about the heat, drought, and fuel production side. One of the reasons it's hard to talk about is you're talking about a whole bunch of different technologies and different kinds of fuels. And they all have their own stories. But water plays a significant role there, too. So here is a DOE figure that shows how much water is required for various kinds of fuel production. The biggest is corn irrigation for corn ethanol, which is the yellow one up on top. The next large one is that long green band in the middle, which is enhanced oil recovery. And then there's a range for different kinds of fuel sources going down. So it really depends. But one thing that's interesting is that the enhanced oil fuel recovery, which is an important part of our oil supply, takes a lot of water, because you're basically pumping a bunch of water underground to push out the oil. Biofuel production, even the refineries, look like they're going to be fairly heavy water users. And there's also the problem that if you have a drought, you may have poor crops. And if you're counting on those crops as a fuel source, you got a problem. Oil shale, which is a big issue right now, requires a significant amount of water. It's not mega scale. Most of the time, I wouldn't think that this would be a huge issue in most places, but if you get a really tight year in terms of water, you could have a big issue. Here's fracking. Fracking requires a bunch of water as well, depending on, I don't know exactly what, but I think part of it is whether it's a vertical or a horizontal well, and it depends on how deep underground the formation is. So, in other words, producing energy in all these various forms requires water. If we have water shortages, we have a problem in fuel production. Now, fuels, unlike electricity, can be stored, so one way to deal with this may be just to keep larger emergency reservoirs on hand to deal with times when we might have to temporarily interrupt some forms of production. Then just quickly about the legal and policy implications. So why is this a concern? Well, first of all, there's the problem of getting electricity in a reliable way, which is sort of one of the key functions of the power system. There are increased environmental impacts through thermal pollution in ecosystems that may already be stressed. There are going to be conflicts between the energy sector and other water users. So you're going to maybe have more fights with agriculture or cities over water supplies. And then there's increased uncertainty, which is a problem by itself for planning, because it's hard to plan for the future when you don't know exactly what it's going to look like or even exactly what the odds are going to be going forward. So that's a planning problem. So what can we do about all this? Well, some of the options involve improved water management. There are a variety of ways to reduce water use by thermal electric plants. Efficiency is not necessarily, in water, has not necessarily been a big priority in the past and is going to get more attention going forward. We may want to have increased storage. That's something we're talking about in California, either in the form of reservoirs or pumping water into depleted aquifers and then pumping it back up again when we need it. And in order to keep the stream flows high, we may want greater efficiency from farmers and other water users, so we have more of a cushion in terms of the amount of water that we would have available in bad years. There are some legal levers that may help pushing people to adopting some of those things. There are water quality requirements under the Clean Water Act. That includes both the thermal pollution limits, which are important, and a familiar issue in the nuclear industry, but also may include state water quality standards, which may either explicitly or by implication require minimum stream flows. Environmental impact statements and the state equivalents, I think it's unorthodox to suggest that these could actually be used for constructive planning purposes, since most people view them as paperwork that may provide leverage in litigation, but doesn't necessarily help the agency. But I'm a dissenter on that. I think that agencies can learn from these impact studies and can improve their planning. Every state has its own public utility commission, and they need to start thinking about this stuff. And then finally, there's the whole complex of water law about who can take water and what they can use it for and so forth, and I'm not going to get into that. There are also energy policy implications. Greater use of renewables is appealing. Windmills don't need water. Solar panels, we were talking about at breakfast, need some water to keep them clean, but it's not on the same scale as thermal plants. Geothermal is another issue. We can hold biofuels in reserve as a hedge. We can increase capacity to move power around, which is something we need for other reasons, but if we had a better, more unified grid, that would help with regional problems. And we can do demand management so we can cut back on power use during these periods when water may really start to be a pinch point in the electricity sector. And that's about it. Thank you very much, and I look forward to the questions.